I think what I'd like to begin with this evening, given that many of you, you know, whether you've just begun to sit recently or have been at it for a long time, are pretty well schooled in the practice and the approach of mindfulness meditation, the insight meditation practice. And over the course of the last couple of months, we've been really focusing a lot on grounding ourselves in the body. You know, knowing the body as body, knowing it as being not separate from all else that creation is comprised of. And this practice tonight that we did was actually quite different. And it was all about expanding beyond that grounding into very different realms of states of consciousness. And so before talking about these things, I'd like to spend just a little time reflecting together on what the nature of your experience was in doing this practice. When Joseph teaches it at Insight Meditation Society and elsewhere, he said, some people find it really rather helpful, as the Buddha intended, for relaxing into the grand, spacious emptiness within which all occurs. He said other people find it kind of annoying. So I'd be interested in any experiences you may have had here, sort of both kinds. So please, if you have anything you'd like to share about the meditation that we did, then please, now's a good time to bring it up. Please.
I thought it was very useful. It gave me kind of a new way of exploring, you know, the whole concept of dissolving into this vast darkness. And yet, so, and I also discovered, and this was the interesting part, a very strong sense of holding.
Yes.
In the middle of it all.
Uh-huh.
As I just sort of relaxed and went a bit in the lab, I thought, what is that? What is that funny feeling that I have?
Yes.
And it was really a tightness, a holding on.
It's actually a fairly common experience in doing this. Because what you really are doing is kind of vivisecting your own consciousness. You know, it's like in the Wheel of Samsara, the illustrations of the Wheel of Samsara, the Nama Rupa, the name and form, the illustration for that is two men in a boat. And it is, they are emblematic of the body and consciousness, that they inhabit the same vehicle. They're not different, but they're not the same. And what's going on here is that you are inviting the mind to let go of the body. You know, to simply turn the attention elsewhere from the experience of body as body. To turn the attention elsewhere from the experience of the discursive mind creating the self. And simply relaxing the consciousness and allowing it to expand outward in all directions. So all that we're really doing is becoming aware of a vast space within which these various phenomena arise. And as it begins to have that effect, it turns out that it's not really the discursive mind's idea of a good time. And it says, oh, this is all very well and good, but, you know, let's not get carried away here. And so that's basically kind of what's going on. There's a certain element of fear. You know, what if I really do let go? What's going to happen to me? You know? And so, you know, it's a normal reaction, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Thank you. Anyone else? Please.
Yeah, it was actually, the word she used, dissolving, it captures that sense. It was the first time I was able to not be so fearful or anxious about something that's coming up that's very body specific.
Yes.
A treatment thing, and I could finally let go of that and be in this much wider space, and it was really sweet, actually.
Yes.
And the noises, the interruptions that were coming, were actually just a way of reminding me that I wasn't thinking about all the other stuff that I've been thinking about. and it just brought me back to, oh, I was in a blank place. I was in that the starry sky space. Anyway, it was making it work for me.
Thank you. There's a highly revered Tibetan meditation teacher from a generation or so ago, Tulku Urgen, is the father of Sogyal Rinpoche and Nyingchö Dorje, who teach Dzogchen practice in the West. And back then, he was leading retreats on the exploration of these states of consciousness that are both very deep and extraordinarily expansive. And so there were these Western students, you know, some pretty senior people who come to sit with him, you know, to receive these teachings there in his monastery in Tibet. And at the same time they were there, he was having a lot of renovation work done on the monastery. And so a couple of rooms down the hall, when he started the retreat, there were people with jackhammers, and they were blasting through the foundation, they were cutting holes in the walls, and there was dust everywhere, and just incredible racket. And so he just started the retreat, and people said, and it was just intolerable for these students, you know. And so very shortly into the retreat, they're saying, why did you schedule this retreat, you know, during this period of time when the noise is horrible and the distractions are overwhelming? And he said, what noise? He said, you simply have not finished allowing the mind to expand sufficiently to take this in. The Buddha, a couple of guided meditations that he did with his kind of wingman, Ananda, and his attendant and whatnot. And there are these two discourses, 121 and 122, in the middle of the discourses of the Buddha, the shorter and greater discourses on voidness, Kula Shunyata. And so the Ananda says, you know, it seems to me that some of the time your consciousness abides in voidness. Is this so? And the Buddha said, yes, it is. And he basically asked him, you know, how do you attain this state of mind that has become empty of all phenomena? That simply resides in the limitless emptiness of the big mind, you know, the unsurpassed mind, as it's called in one of the sutras. And he said, I do it by this means. He said, if you want to do this practice and experience this voidness, you can't do it in a place where it's really busy and there's a lot of social contact with others. He said, I invite you to look about us at our environment. What do you see? You see people moving about and working in shops and trading goods and engaged in the affairs of the day. Okay. And the structures in which they all do this. And he said, normally what happens on a day-to-day basis is that that's where our consciousness is focused, on the immediate environment and the human activity around us and the structures we build in order to conduct these activities. And basically what he did was kind of a gestalt exercise with Ananda. He said, I invite you to focus not on these things that are immediately around and immediately before us. I invite you instead to focus on what is around them. So to kind of turn the attention away from the immediate and the built environment and all the human activity, and instead focus on the greenery around us, on the trees and the bushes and the forest, okay, and the water, you know, the streams and whatnot. So allow the mind's kind of default inclination just to focus on human activity to fade into the background and focus instead on the natural world that makes all of this activity possible. So expand your consciousness beyond the immediacy of the human activity and the human interaction. And instead, focus on this vast green environment that sustains the life of all beings, that makes it possible for us to do these things. So it does that for a while. Focusing on the richness and the vastness of the green environment. So the mind, his mind gets settled into that perspective, that view. So he's moved beyond the view characterized by human activity and human interaction. So he just has him reside in that understanding for a while. And then he said, now I want you to shift your focus from the green world, from the forests and the bushes and the growth, you know, and the wildlife and whatever. Instead, to the earth that makes possible this green life. So he has him do this kind of figure ground shift again. And to focus instead on the mountains. And again, his consciousness is moving outward, like through, like concentric circles. Okay. And focus instead on the mountains, on the vastness that they represent as you see them. We're going from this little circle of human activity and the built environment to the green world that sustains life, to the earth itself that sustains green life, that makes all life possible in the first place. So focusing on the earth. So he does that, you know. Living in a place like we do in Colorado, it's pretty easy to do, isn't it? You go out just about anywhere, whoa, look at that, you know. Vast open space. And so he had his mind reside there for a certain period of time. And he said, now I want you to do this. Once again, to reverse figure and ground. Instead of focusing on the mountains, okay, and the earth, I want you to instead let that fade into the background and focus instead on the sky. On the vastness of the sky. And not just to focus on it, but to allow your mind to move into it. Okay. So in each one of these, he said, allow the mind to move beyond the earth environment and human activity. Allow the mind to move into oneness, intuitive connection with green life. Then allow the mind to move from that into intuitive connection with the earth that makes life possible. And now he's saying, allow the mind to extend beyond the taking in of the vastness of the mountains and the earth. Allow the mind, allow the consciousness to extend, to radiate out into the sky and into space itself. And experience the limitlessness and the emptiness of that reality in an intuitive way. So that's the nature of the guided meditation that the Buddha taught Ananda for having some kind of encouraging, some intuitive sense of what it means to allow the mind to relax into the vastness of space and to become one with it. And he said, if you can do that, if you can allow the mind to go to those spaces, he said, that's, in some ways, it's a trip that never ends. You know, the mind will simply continue to expand into this great vastness. And then you've also transcended any notion of self. And one becomes aware that this is a vastness that we all share. You know, it's all together and personal. It is, you know, our kind of expanding outward in some ways, and the Tibetans talk about this a lot. That's actually what the consciousness is doing when you do this kind of practice. It wants to move into that vastness because it has this intuitive sense that basically what the consciousness is doing is coming home. Like birds migrate, you know, that fly out, you know, from their place of birth and go 6,000 or 8,000 miles or something, and then they come back to their place of birth. You know, he's saying this understanding is that our consciousness was not just born when our folks got it on, you know, that the consciousness was implanted at that point in time, right? But that it came from the void, and to the void it returns. And in fact, when the Buddha, among the Buddha's dying words, you know, done is what needed to be done. You know, now I return. Letting go into that void to not return. Okay. And so this is the ability to get a flavor for an understanding of what it means to simply free the consciousness, to unlock the cell door, unlock it from the shell or the confines of self, and reemerge and reunite with that vast emptiness from which we all came in the first place. And so that's what those meditations that he taught in the Shorter and Greater Discourse on Voidness are all about, is how to free the consciousness to do what it naturally wants to do. You know, like a bird returning, yeah, completing, you know, its migration, coming back home to the place of birth. And so that's the nature of the experience that he was seeking to convey. And he said, when you can do this practice and you can allow this to happen over and over again, he didn't call it death practice exactly, but what he was intimating is that this is what a letting go at its most fundamental is all about, is just allowing the consciousness to expand into limitless space. And his Dzogchen teachers, like Mingzhu Dorji and Sopkin Rinpoche, both of whom I've done some practice with, when we were practicing down at Taramangalo, which is a retreat center in the mountains south of Pagosa Springs, what they would do in the evening at sunset is they'd lead us out there with our cushions and such to sit on the hillside and do this practice as we watched the sunset. And the sunset itself, you know, in this part of the world can be so entrancing. You know, you're sitting there and you're seeing the trees and you're seeing the earth, you're seeing the mountains, and then it's like, you know, the senses and the consciousness are just drawn into the sky. And you can kind of feel, literally feel the consciousness expanding into the sky. Until you kind of become the sunset, you know, which is a useful thing in part because what you're looking at is anicca and anatta. You know, you're looking at a sunset if there's like a few clouds or something, you know, it's absolutely beautiful, it can be quite stunning. It's also absolutely unsubstantial. You know, the only constant is change, you know, the shapes of the clouds change and the colors change. And the whole environment is sort of in flux. And so those are clouds, those are real clouds, right? And all of a sudden, you know, they're gone. Ceaseless change, insubstantiality, that the consciousness is kind of drawn into. You know, so it can be a lovely practice to do. I encourage it highly. You ever find yourself outside and you want to do this sort of thing. So that was probably the most notable in the exposition on the elements is another place where the Buddha teaches the importance of allowing the mind to relax into these spacious states. You know. Also in his teaching on the meditative absorptions, you know, these kind of deep states of samadhi that allow alternative states of consciousness to arise. He used a lot of imagery there that spoke of, you know, that touched on space as well. He said, you know, moving into the mind state of deep, kind of sweet, selfless joy combined with calmness. You know, he said, imagine a vast lake. And in this lake, you find these lily pads floating. Okay. And elsewhere in the lake, the wind may be blowing, there may be artesian wells that are bubbling up from the floor of the lake and disturbing it. But here, in this part of the lake, the water is still and your mind floats just below the surface, you know, floating in peace, you know, abiding in peace, abiding in a still, open state, you know, where there are no wants and needs and there are no fears. The mind is unaffected by fear and longing, as the Buddha said. And it simply rests or floats in its natural state. So these teachings, these words, these images are really rather core to the Buddha's teachings, except they're not featured a great deal in a lot of teachings, or, you know, a lot of Buddha Dharma, sharing of the Dharma, in part because they're kind of mystical, among other things. You know, they're extra rational in nature. Also, as was pointed out earlier, engaging in these practices and getting this flavor for the openness and the limitlessness of that can be challenging. And it needs to be done with care, it needs to be done with kindness, you know. And should you find yourself experimenting with one of these practices, and, you know, the expansion of the consciousness moving out in all directions, and, or, you know, the vast night sky and seeing all phenomena as twinkling stars within it, you know. And you find that sense of uneasiness or not wanting to let go, you know, it's worth respecting. Because what you're doing, literally, is pushing the boundaries. You know? You're kind of experimenting, you're playing with letting go who we think we are, relaxing into the environment. And that's part of what the Four Elements is about, right? Is getting in touch with the earth element within, getting in touch with the water element, with the air element, with the fire element. And then this transition is about, and getting well grounded in the body, right? And then this transition is letting go of all that and allowing the consciousness to expand beyond that into realms that they require a certain amount of courage and grace to enter into. Because they are, in fact, departures from the comfortable space of the constructed self. But to the extent that you find yourself with the opportunity, it happens especially on retreat, but if you have a steady practice going at home, and you have the opportunity to spend a prolonged period of time, an hour or so sometime, to just do a practice similar to this, and if you just go on the internet and Google Joseph Goldstein Big Mind Meditation or Big Sky Meditation, it's right there. And you can just sit in meditation and listen to Joseph do that guided meditation, and it will, you know, be quite a powerful experience. Yeah, you'd be surprised. Okay, so questions, observations, please.
Repeat the names of the discourses, the greater and lesser discourses on, is it consciousness?
On voidness.
On voidness.
Yeah, 121, 122, the Kulya Sunyata, as a 121. The exposition on the elements.
Okay.
So another, I think that's 141 or 144. They're all in the Majjhima Nikaya.
Okay.
But, yeah. Okay. Please.
I love the imagery of the sky as opposed to the land, because it seems as if we have to do something to get to those open spaces, whereas all we have to do with the sky is to look up. The sky is free.
There it is. Yes, and you know, whether you're looking at the sunset or you go to some place like the Grand Canyon or something, you know, you can feel the consciousness just being drawn outward into that vastness. You know, we go to the Grand Canyon a fair amount when we can, and so that's certainly always my experience. Sometimes if I see a soaring bird, kind of focus on that a little bit. It feels almost like, you know, like it's a kind of a drone or something, and my consciousness is along for the ride. You know, I can just see this vast space, you know, from the eyes of the raptor that's soaring over.
And we can see that wherever we are.
Of course.
The sky is there, and this is vast, no matter.
Quite so. An Ojibwe saying that I'm fond of, I know some of you have heard me say before, is that sometimes I go about lost in self-pity, but all the while a wind is moving me across a great sky. Yeah. That same feeling. That whatever's going on in our lives, you know, whether it's the pleasant or the unpleasant or the neutral or whatnot, it is in fact taking place within this vast space, you know. And a greater discourse on the establishing of mindfulness in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, and being mindful of the mind, you know, the Buddha talks about the meditator knows the contracted mind to be the contracted mind. He knows the expanded mind to be the expanded mind, and that's the one imbued with the Brahma Viharas, you know, compassion and selfless joy. Equanimity, love. And he also says in there, he knows the unsurpassed mind to be the unsurpassed mind. And that's what he's talking about there. He's talking about the mind that has let go into the vastness of space.
I was reading a book of daily affirmations, and one was this old learned rabbi and a student, and the student was asking him, so when you die, rabbi, or And you meet God, are you going to, is God going to ask you why you weren't more holy? And he says, and the rabbi's name was Zusa or something like that. And he said, he's going to ask me why I wasn't more Zusa. That was just, and in light of that, can you talk about what selfless joy is? Because in my tradition, Jungian, you know, contemplative tradition, we're trying to find our true self, you know, the person that God created us to be. Mm-hmm. So could you talk a little bit more about what it means, what selfless joy means?
Yes, of course. There are actually four kinds of joy that the Buddha talked about off and on during his teachings. One is what's called pamoja, and what that means is joy dependent on external circumstances. Being at one of your kids' wedding ceremonies or something like that, you know, an occasion of great joy that makes you really happy. Getting something you wanted, somebody giving you a present that you hadn't been expecting and didn't know you wanted until you got it, and then it made you really happy. That's pamoja, okay. It's likened to a breeze blowing over the surface of a lake of water, okay. There's this joy called sukha, and sukha is selfless joy, okay. Sukha is, and the image that the Buddha uses for it is a mountain lake that's fed not by external flows, okay, but instead by artesian well, which is a well under pressure at the bottom of the lake that's bubbling up, okay. And in fact, that image is used for both sukha and another form of joy the Buddha talked about, which is piti, which is usually translated actually as rapture. And that is when the body, when you're sitting in meditation, the samadhi is very deep, and the mind stops creating self. Sometimes you can feel this rush of energy sort of moving up through the body. And it's kind of a bioenergetic sensation, but it's this feeling of joy. The selfless joy of sukha, this welling up, okay, is not dependent on external circumstances. All that's going on when you experience sukha is that you're experiencing one of the side effects of the discursive mind's temporary taking a break from creating the self. All the hindrances are suppressed. And what that does, basically, when the mind is totally relaxed in that way, it's not fabricating the self, is that it spontaneously liberates a fair amount of joy. And you feel happy. You just feel kind of leavened and at ease and at peace with things exactly as they are. Fourth kind of joy is mudita. And what that means is that it's the selfless joy that wants to be shared. It's taking delight in the happiness that you see others experiencing. And wishing that they be happy in the same way that you are. Okay. So when we say selfless joy, it's not the happiness that comes from, it's not what they, you know, what we sometimes call sort of businessman's happiness. It's like, you know, I'll make you happy if you make me happy. A lot of relationships kind of go in a ditch because of that one, you know. Hey, you're not making me happy anymore. Sukha shared is mudita. It's simply this feeling of happiness and well-being within and wanting others to feel the same. Or if you see that they are feeling that you're made happy by that rather than feeling envious. Okay. So it's happiness in the absence of self, basically. Okay. And it is it's one of the kind of constituents of the Brahma Viharas, you know, that which in fact are, but when the Buddha talked about the expanded mind, that's what he's talking about. When you find the consciousness imbued with compassion and selfless joy, you know, the joy that wants, altruistic joy, it's also called an equanimity, compassion, that those are they comprise the guidance system that replaces self. You know, when the discursive mind is in abeyance and these other qualities of mind are coming to the fore, then your motives for speaking and acting and whatnot are guided by those states of mind instead of being guided from like a self-protective state. And so the Brahma Viharas are actually kind of also help prepare the mind for the experience of expanding into space as well. You know, they're kind of related to each other. So we're talking about ideas and concepts, right? And the meditation that we use to kind of get a little taste for what that's about, they're all words and concepts and ideas. But what they're trying to do is to get at the nature of a kind of experience that's available to you, you know, if you allow the mind to settle into it. And so, again, if you have a longer than average period of time available for you to sit, doing something like this meditation can be a real gift to the self. You know, more often than not, as you know, when you do it, you'll find yourself feeling perhaps a little bit more equanimity, and a little more peace of mind, and a little bit more of a tendency to just not take the whole thing quite so seriously. It's just all happening in this great, vast arena, you know, and we abide with it as we can, you know. We respond skillfully when we see things come along that look like they need responding to. Other than that, you know, we allow things to be as they are.
Boy, can you remind us what discursive mind is, just briefly, discursive mind?
It's, when I use that phrase, I mean sort of storytelling mind.
That's a good
You know, idea. The that's mind that's in the constant process of telling us who we are, of conjuring self. Okay, this is who I am, this is my social security number, this is my job, this is, these are my degrees, you know, here's my resume, you know, it's here's where I live, and here's what kind of car I drive, and here's what I like and what I don't like and what I don't care about, and all that stuff, you know. So, and it, for most of us, actually, you know, and this includes going back to the Buddha's time, that's the mind's default option, right? We just kind of scurry around. The Buddha called it I-making and me-making, you know, selfing.
So would that be synonymous with persona? Not quite.
Not altogether. I think that word actually captures a lot more, you know. Okay. As it's understood in Buddha Dharma, I-making and me-making, the way the Buddha described it, is simply a sequence of mental processes. It's just something the mind does. And so a lot of, you know, the maturation meditation practice is first coming to the realization that that's what the mind's doing. Oh, okay, here I am selfing, right? But, you know, the really frustrating thing about it is that we get to the point where we can readily recognize it, but we still can't stop doing it. You know, and Ajahn Chah, the Thai forest meditation master, said, well, that's one of the real frustrations of this practice, is that we get increasingly attuned to what the mind is up to, but the tendencies of mind are so strong that in some cases all we can do is to continue to watch it doing it until it runs its course, and hopefully not speak or act too unskillfully in the meantime. There's again, I think it's from Shuang Buddhism, an ancient Chinese anecdote about this very skilled young horseman who goes into the forest and he captures this really wild and powerful horse, and he brings it back to the village and he starts training it using all of his skill and whatnot. And a few days later, he's seen, you know, galloping madly through the village at a breakneck pace, and somebody calls out to him, you know, where are you going in such a hurry? And he shouts back, I don't know, ask the horse. Sometimes it just feels like we're riding this wild horse, you know, and it's going to rip along and go where it's going to go, and hopefully not try to sweep you off of a tree branch in the meantime. And then after a while, it gets tired, and then we get back to the cushion and start over again. Please.
So another question came up for me when I was doing guided meditation. This last week I was camping for 3 days in the mountains, mm-hmm. in a very isolated place. Mm-hmm. And I think for the first time ever, I felt at one, I felt connection mm-hmm. with where I was. And I, as you were doing the guided meditation, I think my mind was kind of trying to understand if there were parallels mm-hmm. or, I mean, in some ways, it seemed to me as though being that connected to the environment is different than what you're talking about. You're talking about getting rid of all that, maybe. But I don't know, it was a really wonderful feeling.
Yes.
I didn't feel I was myself. I felt I was a part of this.
I think what we're basically speaking about is states of expanded consciousness. You know, I think that, and I've had the kind of experience that you're talking about as well, when there's just this sense of okay, I'm here, I'm in this place of sanctuary, of refuge, you know. I can stop making up the self for a while. And when you do that, it's as if the environment is beckoning you, you know. Come forth, and what it says in the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation on hearing in the Bardo, step out of the small self, this body of fear, you know, rest in kindness and generosity of heart. That it's where the consciousness wants to go. And the sense of boundaries dissolves. And there is no separation, and there is no difference, you know. As Robertson Jeffers said in one of his poems, not man apart, you know, to really experience the utter lack of otherness, you know, between us and that which is around us. And then this experience of space is simply moving beyond that sense of oneness with nature and the natural surroundings to oneness with the universe. One is not sort of inherently superior to the other. They're both states of elevated or expanded consciousness. And they both have, I mean, they're both extremely powerful teachings as far as the nature of who we are, or think we are, in terms of what the mind is capable of. It's like we've been listening to AM talk radio all the time, and all of a sudden, turns out there's a lot of bandwidth out there, you know, that we haven't been able to tune into, and that's basically all that's happening here, is that the consciousness becomes capable of experiencing both the environment and the cosmos in ways that, you know, we have not before. And that's all the Buddha's trying to indicate in these guided meditations that he teaches. You know, it's a big world out there. And here's a way you can kind of start to tap into it a little bit. Thank you. Thank you. Anything else? Yes, please.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you about your use of the phrase, that your mind, if you find your mind has collapsed around a story. And I heard that collapse. I just didn't quite know.
Sure. Many years ago, I had a really, really serious bike accident, and there is some suspicion that I might have a brain tumor and would need to have it operated on. And then it was decided it wasn't a brain tumor; it was this aneurysm that maybe going to blow out, or that maybe it was going to reabsorb on its own. And so they said, well, you know, we could do surgery, but sometimes you have a stroke when you do the surgery, and or we could just let's see if it reabsorbs on its own. And so I thought maybe I'd go that route. But in the process, I was in communication with Dharma friends and whatnot, and I had some really meaningful correspondence with Sharon Salzberg, you know, friend and teacher. And she talked about when she faced a similar situation, when there is some suspicion that maybe she had ovarian cancer, and they were doing some tests, and they were getting ready to send her into surgery, and she would say, you know, I knew there were all these friends of mine who were sending me metta and well wishes, you know, and I was certainly doing it for myself. And sometimes I could just be at peace and feel a certain amount of equanimity. And then she said, all of a sudden, it felt like the mind contracted around the terror and the fear, and that there was nothing else in her universe. You know, that the mind was infused with terror and fear, and there was no space around it. It was just that and nothing else. And then she realized that was what was happening. And then gradually it would open up again. And she would feel the space get bigger. You know, that yes, there is this potential for a life-threatening disease, you know, condition. There is the Dharma. There are my friends. there is my practice of metta for myself. The sun is shining. The flowers are blooming. And yes, there's the fear. In Buddha Dharma, and certainly in my experience, courage is not the absence of fear. The absence of fear is fearlessness. You know. Courage, rather, is the being in the presence of fear with faith and equanimity. You know, faith in yourself. And faith in the universe, you know, and manifest that it's things will turn out as they're going to turn out, but you have faith in your ability to see yourself through it, and you can face whatever happens with a certain sense of acceptance and peace of mind, right? And so there can be the courage, there can be the equanimity, there can be the steadfastness, all in the presence of the fear. And the sun is shining, and the flowers are blooming. All these other things are going on as well. And that can be the ultimate value of being able to do a practice like this, when it's possible to do. When the mind contracts around the fear, that's what's going on, you know. And the power of mindfulness is being able to see when that's happened. You know, you can experience terror, you know, you can feel panic, you know, the body gets, the breath becomes short, the body becomes, you know, sweaty and whatnot. And then that's followed by a moment of mindfulness. You say, oh, this is fear. This is terror. Okay. In that moment of mindfulness, you are not terrified. In the moment of mindfulness, you become aware of the fact that you were terrified a moment ago. Because that's where your consciousness is now. It's mindful of the fact that you were just afraid. And you may be in the next minute, you know, and the one after that. But to the extent, you know, it's like when you're watching digital television, when your signal's not good, you know, all of a sudden it starts to break up and gets all dodgy and there's just little squares and whatnot. What you're doing when you're practicing mindfulness is you're watching this terrible drama, you know, it's like a hospital soap opera, you know, and there's just terrific drama and all these things are going to happen, it's going to be horrible. But then all of a sudden, when there's mindfulness, it's like it breaks up the signal. You know, oh yeah, this is a really bad soap opera I'm watching. And the space expands around it. You know, it's why this practice is so powerful. And then you can say, oh yeah, this is a big field. There really is terror, and it's understandable. And the sun is shining, the flies are blooming. Yeah, please.
Isn't this terror and fear what our friend with the yellow head is trying to evoke?
It has been surmised that this may in fact be what's going on. There's this, you know, whole circuitry in the brain, you know, the limbic system, the amygdala, and it comes from a super primitive part of the brain, one that's different from the prefrontal cortex where reasoning and logic takes place. And to the extent you can keep people terrified, it interferes with rational thought. And so some political leaders down through history have found it very beneficial to keep people afraid, because when they're afraid, they tend to revert to a childlike state of mind where they look for a parent, an authority figure, to take over to make them safe. You know? So part of this kind of mind training is in fact one means of training yourself to not be so easily manipulated by those who would seek to influence thought by fear. It's true.
You mentioned faith, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes. The question was, what about faith? Sort of what role does it play in Buddha Dharma? And the Buddha distinguished in his discourses a lot between faith and belief. And he taught that to found your spiritual practice on beliefs, you know, it's a little like building houses on sand, you know, that if you decide that you're going to, you know, put your lot in with a certain spiritual leader or teacher because all of your friends are, because he's really rich, you know. One of my Burmese teachers, Sister Dipankara, said, you know, whenever you teach the Dharma, you must remember that many beings will come to listen to you. Some you can see, some you cannot. So, yeah, he said to do a practice because your buddies are doing it, or because it's a wealthier, impressive person, or because of the charisma of the teachers, and you know that melts away, and you find yourself cynical and no better off than you were before. Faith, you know, he talked about different kinds of faith, but basically, when he was asked, well, why should we believe you more than we should anybody else? And he basically said, you shouldn't. The orientation of my teaching, teach one thing and one thing only. Why is there suffering and how it can be brought to an end? If that is likewise your goal, if that's something you want to learn, then I recommend you experiment with these practices that I offer. I recommend you experiment with the ideas I've put forth. You know, the reality of suffering, the origins of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the means to bring it to an end, the Eightfold Path, the means for doing so. Said, if your goal is my goal, I recommend that you try these practices, that you investigate these teachings. If, based on your own experience, you find that they do help alleviate your suffering, they do help you to begin to develop insights into a path to freedom, then by all means, you should do those practices and you should continue to study those teachings. And as that happens, do the practice, you do the teachings, whoa, stuff seems to work, okay? Then what you have done is to verify the teachings and the practices with your own experience. And it becomes reiterative. It's kind of like kneading bread dough, okay? So you find yourself feeling kind of affirmed, or finding yourself in alignment with what the Buddha taught. You know, I think this guy was onto something. You know, it seems to be working for me. It seems to be having the desired effect. I think I want to learn more about this. I think I want to study a little more deeply. I think I want to practice a little more deeply and see if it continues to have that effect. So you have this, when you're setting out on the path, he has what he calls bright faith. And you say, this stuff really may work, and I'm willing to throw my lot in and see if it does. And then if, in fact, you find that it's beneficial, then that affirms that faith, you know, and it becomes more and more well-founded. And you're going to have hard times, and there are going to be doubts that arise. And either you'll decide this path isn't for you, and you'll go off and do another one, or you'll work through the doubts. And if, in fact, that happens, then you come back, and the faith is probably stronger than it was before. So it is essentially, rather than just believing a doctrine because somebody told you to, it's knowing the truth of the doctrine in your own state of being, because you've lived it, you haven't just heard the words. It has, in fact, become your Dharma. It has, in fact, become the truth of your own being. And that is, and then as a result of that kind of reiterative process, then the faith simply gets stronger and stronger over time. And so it can be a really powerful companion to have when fear and anxiety arise. Because you understand that fear and anxiety are simply in the nature of the mind to occur. And the Dharma is not going to make them go away. It's not going to keep them happening. What it can do is to fundamentally renegotiate our relationship with the anxiety and the fear when they do arise. So if you're, you know, up against some kind of bad medical diagnosis or something like that, absolutely there's going to be fear. Absolutely there's going to be kind of contracting of the mind. And there's the Dharma. Okay, this is fear. No, I understand. It's the fear body talking. It's the nature of our being. You know, we don't want to die, even though there's a lot of evidence that eventually we're going to. You know, turns out.
Could you recommend anybody to read more about that?
Sure. Well, Sharon Salzberg wrote a book, the title of which is Faith.
Oh, what is it?
I recommend it highly. Huh?
What's the name?
Faith.
That's the name.
That's the title of the book. Huh?
It's Faith, Trusting Your Deepest Experience.
What?
The subtitle is Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience, which is what we were just talking about.
Just FYI, I'm giving a talk on faith next Sunday.
Yay! What a great segue into ending our time together here this evening. If you'll please, just for a moment, take your sitting posture again, while the eyes are gently closed, the attention to come to rest on the breathing. And thus shall ye think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. See you in 2 weeks.